Dorothy Susskind, welcome. Dorothy is an associate professor in the Education and Counseling Department at Longwood University in Farmingville, Virginia. She researches and writes extensively on workplace bullying. Dorothy is on the executive board of the National Workplace Bullying Coalition, and she's the author of Workplace Bullying, Finding Your Way to Big Tent Belonging. And I can't wait to talk to her about this book. Dorothy, thank you so much for taking part in this conversation titled Navigating Workplace Bullying, Finding Resilience and Feeling Joy, Even in Crisis. Dorothy, thank you. I have so much to talk to you about.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm really excited for this conversation.
It's so kind of you to say. So lots to talk about, because what you write about and what you study resonates so much with my experience with workplace incivility in my world, which was television production in New York. So let's start with this. I came across a terrific article you wrote for Psychology Today, and I believe the title was Workplace Bullying, Weaponizing Belonging at Work. And I'm interested in this theme of belonging at work. So tell us a little bit of what the piece is about, and what do you mean by weaponizing belonging at work?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would say people have so many definitions of like what workplace bullying is, what it looks like. And I usually think about workplace bullying really as like this purposeful degradation of a person's character through strategies such as gossip is a big one, sabotage, gaslighting, exclusion, ostracization, really for the ultimate purpose of pushing that person out of a community. And that really ultimate like, sense of unbelonging, not belonging to your work community, but so often, like most tragically, like no longer feeling like you belong to yourself.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, because it does ruin your self-esteem, harm your self-worth, at least in my experience. And I'll talk a little bit about my experience in this regard. And you know, we also often talk about the workplace as your second family kind of thing. And, you know, from kindergarten or even nursery school, we want to feel like we belong. So how deeply entrenched is this feeling of belonging? And why is it so hurtful when we feel like all of a sudden we don't have a sense of belonging at work?
Yeah, that's, there are a couple different things. Like you said, most of us spend more time at work than we do at home or in other communities. So work really becomes like this central playground where we find our meaning and where we find our self-worth and where we find our friends. And the thing that can be so hard in bullying, all the people that I've interviewed across the world will say, you know, the attacks, the specific attacks from the bully herself, that was hurtful. But what really got me was that I had these people that, you know, came to my house for Christmas and, you know, we spent, you know, weekends together and I thought we were really good friends. And then this bullying started and they all just turned their back on me and pretended, you know, like I was this person that I never was. And not only did they ostracize me, but they kind of joined in on the attacks. And it's that unbelonging that I think is more painful than anything. And there's a gentleman named Goffman, and he'll talk about like total institutions, places where you eat and you sleep and you work. And you can think of places like fire and rescue, or like if you're at a boarding school, and especially at these total institutions, when you lose your community, you lose so much. It's not just a job. It's like this whole world that's been ripped away.
Well, and so many of us, especially those of us who get targeted, mm-hmm. I've found, and somebody said to me early on in my research about this, because we were just talking a few minutes before we hit record, I never really understood that I was being bullied. I understood that I felt I wasn't being treated the way I thought I deserved to be treated, because I was hardworking, devoted, productive, and loyal. And I thought, you know, why am I not getting the appreciation back? And so does your research go into a little bit about why people like us, and I found that there's many of us like that. We're not talking about the people that show up to work late, don't do assignments, don't care about the work, leave early. why are we mistreated, those of us who really care? Because that's where the moral injury, and you use that term, and I'm interested about the term moral injury, but it hurts us even more because we're so devoted and dedicated to the work.
Yeah, so there are a couple things that kind of bubbled up from the research. There are some kind of common characteristics we see that people that are different in any way, how they look, how they talk, how they think, that can be one piece. People that are just curious, you know, they're asking questions, they're trying to figure things out, certainly being creative and innovative, and they come in and they're looking at institutional problems and they're trying to kind of figure out what might go wrong or what might have been going wrong. That can make you a target. And what we see again and again in the literature is we'll have organizations that will say, you know what, we've got a problem going on here. We want someone to come in to look at this with fresh eyes and do things differently, help us kind of take a different path. And then they get that person who they ask to come in and be a change agent. And then he starts doing that work and they're like, oh, whoa, no, we don't actually want you to do it. So those characteristics, 100%. The other thing that we know definitively is that whistleblowing. So if you come in and call out any kind of bad behavior, it could be incivility, and sometimes it's things that are actually illegal and unethical, that will 100%, or I shouldn't say 100%, but most often get you bullied. And the thing that's so tragic is the numbers differ, but somewhere like hovering around like 70% of people that are bullied will lose their job. They might quit. They might be constructively discharged. They might be transferred to an undesirable location, but it all comes out the same. They lose their job.
Yeah. And in my experience, and I don't know if you've seen this in the research, and it's kind of a nuance about what you're talking about, Dorothy, but it almost felt like, and I'm not a shy person, I'm not a timid person. I was never bullied as a young person. I played three sports. I was pretty popular in high school. I had lots of friends. There was no such thing. It was never a concern. But I always felt like a little bit that the bully could smell me. And of course, that probably doesn't come off in your research. But they knew, my bullies knew that when they were treating me unfairly, disparagingly, that I would just go back to my desk and try harder and to try to do better. And I was already the hardest worker. So my question is, but I think they also sensed that I didn't agree with their approach to things. You know, that I didn't go along with their bullying. I didn't sidle up to them and laugh along with them. That I think that they knew that I was not going to be a part of that, and that bothered them. Have you heard that? Is that a thing?
Yeah, that absolutely is a thing. And that's where the belonging is. So my thought, my kind of theory, and I'd love your thoughts on this, is that bullying is really about a maladaptive chance to belong. And so you have someone like you, and a lot of times I'll call that person a creative who thinks differently, is curious, is hardworking. We also see that creatives tend to be experts in their field, well-liked, and that you would really have this belief that the more diverse voices in the room, the more ideas that come to the table, the better, right? Like, we want everyone to belong. We want this big tent. And then the bully is kind of operating from a different system. A lot of times the bully will create what I call like a closed circle. And in that closed circle, and I'll say that closed circle to me is created because the bully has some insecurity, doesn't feel confident in her ability, is kind of jealous of others. And so creating this closed circle gives that bully a sense of control and a sense of feeling powerful. But to be part of that closed circle, most often the bully will have really close and tight norms. And so if you don't follow those norms, then you're out. And then the bully, whereas the creative's like, I want to cross collaborate. I want to meet all these different people. The bully's going to say, no, I want to create community by something that Brené Brown mentions, which I really like, called common enemy intimacy. So to be part of our group, we're going to hate the same things and we're going to hate the same people. So the belonging is really based on exclusion.
Yeah. Exactly. I keep thinking as you're talking about all the circumstances where I experienced just what you're talking about. So let me try one on you. So interesting, what your research has found. So I was working for a television show. I will say that it was, I'm sure people are pretty familiar with Dr. Phil. This was a similar type of show.
Gotcha.
And the show, I think you'll find this funny. There's not that much funny about workplace bullying, but there's a few things. This show was supposed to be, the entire theme was empathy, that the host of the show was supposed to be empathetic to all the guests that came on, whereas Dr. Phil kind of scolds you a little bit and things like that. This was empathy. Anyway, it was, and you've also, and I don't really want to gender it because I've had mostly male bullies, but I've had female bullies as well. And you've mentioned she bullies in your kind of informal conversation here. I've had both. In this case, I was working and it was a female-oriented talk show. And it was always supposed to be about empathy. The host was going to be really nice to the guests and help them through these traumas and so forth. Dorothy, it was the most toxic work environment I've ever been in. And it was 95% female staff. And the entire upper echelons, I was a senior producer, the upper echelons were all women. And I love working for women. But I had a staff of my own. I stopped counting at about a dozen young staffers that came into my office crying because of the toxic environment. The reason I mention this is the executive producer was completely ostracized at one point before we even came on the air. And she came to me. I loved her. I adored her. And she was just the kind of person you were talking about. Collaborative, kind, really smart. She had an unbelievable background. She was the executive producer. At one point, they just ostracized her. They stopped inviting her to meetings. They stopped inviting her to conversations about the show. We hadn't even gotten on the air yet. And the reason I mentioned that is they fired her on the day of the launch meeting of the show. You know, the show was airing for the first time that day. She was so kind of just out of it by virtue of being ostracized. It affected her so much. They still invited her to the party and she went, you know, because she was just like, from all the abuse that she took, she was just in a dizzying state. And I told her, don't go to the party. And she went anyway. And the other thing I want to mention real quick, and I know this is going on, but also because everybody knew that she was on the outs, I think everybody was scared to involve themselves with her because they didn't want to see the bosses talking to her. So you're this pariah. I guess that's the point I want to make. Not only are you away from the community, but even people that worked with you before don't want to be seen with you because they know that you're on the outs and that you're not in with the top leadership. So what does that kind of thing tell you? And have you heard those kinds of stories before?
Yes. It's so interesting when I'll talk to people, they'll be like, you will never guess what happens next. And yeah. I can totally guess what happens next. And I almost always can because it follows this cycle. I think a lot of what you're describing is what I call a degradation society, a degradation ceremony. And there's this gentleman named Harold Garfinkel. He wrote an article like in the 50s called The Conditions of a Successful Degradation Ceremony. And it wasn't about bullying, but it fits. But in bullying, to me, what kind of happens in a degradation ceremony is you have this person, like I mentioned before, with really strict group norms. And then someone breaks the group norms by doing something that you would think organizations would want. Like you're talking about this woman, you know, accomplished, smart, creative.
She was terrific.
Exactly. Productive. And then you will have the bully who will be like the denouncer and will speak with this omnipotent voice. And basically say, this person is stigmatized. And that stigmatization is really big. I have a colleague named Laura Zurich, and she talks about sticky stories. Well, you'll create this story that's completely untrue, but it's really, really juicy. And people just kind of want to hear it and they grab onto it. But part of the reason that bullies will create that sticky story is because bullying only works if it's done in a full community. The community has to buy in. So when that story is told, everybody in the community needs to say, yes, we agree. This person is bad. This person doesn't, you know, deserve to be here. So for the good of the community, we need to push her out. And that's really that degradation piece. And it sounds like that's what happened to her. And that's why the ostracization and exclusion works, because it's not by just one or two people. It's like everyone in the organization will talk to you.
Yeah. And we all felt powerless. I mean, I was confiding. She was one of the best bosses I ever had.
Absolutely.
And nobody would talk. And then, you know, she got fired. They brought in a new executive producer, and we were working 14, 16-hour days every day.
Imagine.
I'd be there, Dorothy, I'd be there on a Sunday morning at 8 o'clock in the morning because we might have a show to prepare for Monday or Tuesday, and we'd be there till 11 o'clock or midnight, and I had a newborn. I mean, just awful.
I imagine.
And the new executive producer would come in maybe at 10 o'clock or 11. Me and my staff had been there until 8, and it was a small office. And her office was two doors down from mine. She would come in and walk right by my office. My office door would be open. She wouldn't mention a word to me, the new executive producer. She had been there for a little while already, and I knew about her. And she would walk back and forth in front of my office and never say a word to me. You know how hurtful that is, that you're there for 14 hours? I never did anything to this woman other than try to do the best I could. And once she became the interim executive producer, she would be there all day, and she wouldn't even say a word to me. You know, I don't understand that behavior.
Yeah.
It was so hurtful. So, and these things stay with you. I mean, they stay with you for such a long time. And I just don't understand why people act that way, which is one of the reasons I learned from the worst. I tried to treat my staff in a much more understanding and compassionate way. So moving on from that, let's talk about your book, because it does get into a lot of this. And the book's titled Finding Your Way to Big Tent Belonging. And you take kind of a unique approach to your storytelling. Can you go into a little bit more about how the book's written and who it's for, who it's written for?
Yeah, sure. So I'm what they call a narrative inquiry researcher, and that's a qualitative type of research. And what we do is we just study a phenomenon. And that's just like, you know, one of those fancy research words. But for this study, the phenomenon is workplace bullying. And I was bullied myself and really wanted, you know, to understand what had happened. Because like you, I had no idea what was going on until it was just really too late.
So, and can I just ask real quickly, we don't need to get into the specifics of the bullying you experienced, but was that the impetus or the inspiration to, you know, create this career now and this focus on workplace incivility?
Yeah, definitely in part. I mean, I've always been a professor for decades now and always been a researcher and have done, you know, had different strands of that research. But the workplace bullying specifically really did kind of grow out of that experience. Because, you know, when we're trying to understand what happened to us, we fall back on our skills. And so for me, you know, I'm reading all the peer review journals, talking to experts, and then I launched this study. And basically, in a narrative inquiry study, we're really careful not to ask many questions. Like everything's anonymous. I collect basic demographic information and geographic information. But outside of that, I just asked two questions. I just said, tell me a time when you were bullied and tell the story of a time you worked in an environment where you felt inspired and you could be creative and do innovative work. And then I think at the end, I have like 800 or 900 pages of data. And then we go through and just code the data and look for like themes that pop up and then collapse themes into categories and all of those things. And in narrative inquiry, what I'm looking for is what's the story of the phenomenon. So I was trying to figure out, you know, what are the typical settings? Who are the typical characters? What's the plot trajectory? So the book in many ways is talking about the characters, the plot, the setting, and then like, wow, what do you do once it happens? Because sometimes I'll think about, you know, like Kubler-Ross talks about the stages of grief, and most of us have heard of the stages of grief. So when you have a great loss and you're angry, that makes sense. You're like, yeah, I know that's a normalized stage. But in bullying, like you were saying, most people, I should say, don't know what bullying looks like. So just really, if you understand the cycle, it's empowering because you're like, oh, this isn't just me. And it also, if you're in the middle of it, helps you to predict what could happen next. So the book is really for people that have been bullied, people that are managers, and also I hope people that are in human resources so they have that opportunity to, you know, to see like, because so often the bully will complain about this amazing person to human resources. And if the HR kind of knows this is the cycle, they can be like, wow, that's really strange because he's been a top performer for decades and he has all these accolades. So the things you're saying just don't add up.
Yeah. So I think I want to go back a second. I mean, and I think so many people that I've talked to, and this is true in my own case, and sometimes I feel like I'm coming off self-defensive because it's like, I think sometimes you can't help but think, I know people are hearing the story and they're saying, in my case, Andy must have done something, you know, to bring this on. And I really haven't gotten there. You know, like in almost every job I had, I was promoted 2 or 3 or 4 times in that job, but the bullying still occurred. And so because I think as I've talked to people, there's always that hesitation of being like, you know, how could this happen and why? But I want to go back to something else about your book and about who it's for. I mentioned that I had a newborn when I was going through this horrific show experience and the incivility, not just to me, but to the entire staff and how toxic it was. But even when you have a good home life, whatever that means, you know, a support system at home, it feels like nobody can help you when you're being bullied. And again, I was a manager, I was an executive producer, and I wanted to shield it from my staff. And I also didn't want anybody to know it was affecting me.
And, of course.
And so I will acknowledge, and I say this in my book, that I was not a great partner at that time because I just felt so uncomfortable in my body and so much anxiety. And I was having digestive problems and kind of hypervigilance. Every time an email came in from the bully, I'm like, oh, you know. And so in your research or in the book, I think you talk a little bit about, and I think it would be helpful to people who are also trying to kind of assimilate their home life with this difficult work situation.
Yeah. And are you thinking about kind of healing strategies or?
Yeah. And how maybe your family can adapt to what you're going through or how you can better deal with what you're going through.
Yeah, that's a really important thing to think about because the research is really clear that when you're going through a trauma, and certainly workplace bullying is a trauma, that you are bringing that home and that it negatively impacts relationships. Sometimes it even breaks relationships up, which is just so incredibly tragic. So there are a couple different things. I think first that we have to kind of give ourselves some grace about what's happening. We know that when people are being bullied, and that, you know, that is like this emotional wound, but the same areas in the brain that light up for physical pain light up for emotional pain. So it's not distinguishing. The other thing we know is that when you are anticipating what the bully's going to do next, and bullying's always going to do something next, and it's probably going to be worse. That anticipation also changes brain structure. So we can see on scans that there are actually things that are changing. So that's really real. A lot of times we'll see that the first time people really realize they're being bullied, it's a primary care physician that will say, well, you know, your blood pressure is really high, or you've lost a lot of weight, or you're losing hair. What's going on? I think knowing about the cycle and how it unfolds, what that trajectory is, and explaining it to your spouse or to your partner is really, really helpful, that education piece, because people will say very well-meaning, but it's just a job. Don't worry about it. It's just a personality conflict, not a big deal. Get another job. And for them just to understand how this unfolds, and though most often, when possible, it is best to get another job. We also know it's not that easy. You know, people have to pay bills. You're taking care of a family. And so often our jobs, you know, if I'm a professor, which I am, just to get another job, if, you know, you're, it's not like I would have to change states. It's in, and because the world is so small, when your reputation is being, when you are just going through that character assassination, then that makes it hard for you to get another job. But
because you also, you can't use those people necessarily as a reference, you know. And I just wanted to add, and for, please forgive me for the interjection. I just wanted to mention, I loved being in journalism. I still am. I love being news. I love being the center of things. I love storytelling. And so a couple of things. One, I had worked so hard to get where I was, where I created my own shows and they were on nationally and things like that, that even though it kind of ruined the experience because of the pressure I was under and the lack of civility on the part of the boss. And to the point about a lot of times I didn't get bullied all that often, but you just didn't know when it was going to happen. And because the boss was a bully all the time, just he was doing it to other people and his focus was on other people. You never knew when it was going to be you again. And you do such a nice job in the research that I did talking about some of these issues into how to deal with this from a personal standpoint. You know, I ended up having suicidal ideation, you know, I never came close to doing, you know, acting on it, but it got that bad. And You write a lot about these different shifts. And I don't know if you think about this all the time, but like you talk about a first shift is when you start to look at other opportunities, or a second shift about rebuilding your community. Can you go into a little bit more detail on some of these solution-based approaches as opposed to doing what I did, was which was feeling a lot of shame and having suicidal ideation and so forth?
Yeah, of course. And I'm just, again, I'm so sorry. Those are the hardest interviews that I do, is when a parent or of an adult child or a partner reaches out from someone that they love dearly that was bullied over an extended period of time and ended up taking their lives. Yeah. That's just to understand how incredibly serious it is.
So that does happen.
Yes, it does happen. And these are not surprises. This is bullying that's well documented. The person was seeking mental help, trying to get assistance from their organization. So yeah, that's how serious it is. I think the things that you were referring to there, sometimes we'll talk about post-traumatic growth, and Tadeshi and Calhoun, who are at University of North Carolina, Charlotte, did a lot of that research about how can we take something that was so deeply traumatic and come out stronger. And I think first, it's really important that we're not talking about toxic positivity, that this was great and I'm so glad it happened, because in all of these circumstances, I would, I'm sure you would, if we could erase that piece of our lives, then we 100% would. But now that it happened, part of this is, where can I find meaning in it? And you're not going to necessarily find cause, but where can I find meaning? And I think that first piece, we know that so much of the trauma of bullying is the unbelonging, that revocation of belonging. So that kind of first step is to create a new circle of belonging. And that might mean moving jobs, but that doesn't have to be it. It can be, you know, participating in a running group. I enjoy writing. I am a writer, and I'll do writing workshops in prisons. I mean, things that bring you joy, and you come into this community and you feel part of something that's bigger than yourself. So somehow to first like reestablish that community, because that is that moment when you start to feel like, oh, I actually do have worth. And then that kind of shift allows you to kind of get that confidence back. And since so much of bullying is you lose your sense of self, you start to get that sense back. And then you can look at that experience a little bit from a distance, that bullying experience, and then start to find the meaning. There's that idea that kintsugi, the Japanese pottery, when it breaks, instead of just gluing it back together or throwing it away, you know, to actually repair it with this beautiful gold lacquer. So you have this beautiful pot with these beautiful cracks that now have gold in them. So part of like, I'm not going to, for a long time, sometimes we'll try to assimilate our bullying experience into our everyday. And that doesn't work because it just shattered so much of who you are. So you almost have to create this whole new story. And that's where that community building comes in and connecting to something larger than yourself. For some people, that's religion or spirituality, but it certainly doesn't need to be. And then I think the other piece is there are all kinds of really powerful strategies to use for writing. And that can be so healing. I'm not sure if that would be something helpful to hear.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. I can tell, do you want me to tell you a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. We've got a couple minutes remaining. Please do.
Yeah. So some of the things, there's a gentleman named Penny Baker, and he talks a lot about just really well documented. He's worked with all kinds of populations that just writing like 3 or 4 times a week for like 10 minutes about things that are bothering you can be really transformative. And one of the things that an idea that I got from my therapist, and I think that when you're bullied, if you have the resources and ability to work with a counselor or a therapist, it's really important. But something that she told me to do, and I've shared this so many times, is I actually have a jar on my bookshelf, and I take the jar down and I take the top off, and I'm like, okay, this is my time to write. And then I'll actually start writing about what's on my mind, what I'm thinking about. And then when I'm done, I'll put that top back on the jar and put it up. Does a couple things. It keeps me from ruminating during the day because I do have like this set moment when I'm going to write. But as far as like what I write about, one of the early things that can be really helpful is to try to write out your timeline. Because we know any kind of trauma is stored in your senses. And so it's really nebulous. But if you can start to kind of make it concretely on the page, that can be healing and it can validate you because so often you'll be like, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal. I don't know why I'm so upset about it. And then you go back and you look at your timeline and you're like, oh, this is a really big deal. Of course I'm upset about it. Another thing that can be helpful, you mentioned that idea of moral injury, which is a gentleman, a researcher named Jonathan Shea, is to kind of think like, what was the moral injury? Because people can have two of the exact same experiences, but different moral injuries. Is it a sense of fair play? You know, I'll talk to people that work in schools and hospitals, and they're like, we're abandoning our mission. Like we're supposed to be here taking care of students or patients, and we're not doing that work. So I think that can be really helpful. And then also when you write, it's helpful to keep writing your story, but again and again, but you want it to evolve. And some things that I'll look for in my writing and the writing of others is that you want it, instead of just to be episodic, to have some kind of cohesion that you start to see the narrative arc. And there's a gentleman named Adler was McAdams' student that said you can have kind of two types of stories. You can have a redemptive story or a contaminated story. And it all has to do with the ending valence, like how it ends. So if the story is just contaminated, it's all bad. It's really hard to get out of the muck. But if you can start to see some redemptive moments, and the redemption doesn't mean you can fix it, but just this is when I held to my values. This is when I helped this person, even though I got beat up for it. That's really helpful. And sometimes we'll say if there's no redemption, you just need to change the chapter breaks. So maybe you're ending it at a certain place. So with your bullying experience, it might be hard to see the redemption. But now when you're doing this conference and you're helping all these people, now you've got a redemptive narrative.
Yeah. Well, so much of what you're talking about, this has been so helpful because that's what I've been working on. I thought my career was a failure when I looked back on it. And I've totally changed my perspective. I feel like I'm doing the things and trying to do many of the things that you just spoke about and that you write about. And I feel so much differently, so much better. And I'm going to continue doing the things you're talking about. It's been a catharsis talking with you, Dorothy, and thank you. You're just terrific. You're a great interview, but the material and the information, the research is so valuable. So thank you again for something that was important to me. I know interesting and engaging for the audience. Really appreciate it. So I have so many more questions for you. We don't have time for that, but I'm sure other people do. So how can people best reach out to you to learn more about your work and get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Probably the easiest is just my website, which has my book and my writings and my contact information. And it's super simple. It's just my name, DorotheSuskin.com. And also you can check out my articles on Psychology Today, and my book certainly has that information. And people reach out to me all over the world, like each week, and I love talking to people. So please don't hesitate.
Well, great. I've loved talking with you and connecting with you, and I look forward to further conversations. Final word from me. We call ourselves bully targets, but now let's aim to change the workplace for good. Thank you for watching.
Thank you.